Welcome to Clinical Conversations 116th podcast. It comes to you from Journal Watch, whose website is jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. It's March 25th, 2011. I'll be joined shortly by Dr. Danielle Scherer of Physicians First Watch and the Medical University of South Carolina. This time we talk with Dr. Nicholas Mills about his JAMA paper examining the clinical implications of a more sensitive troponin-1 assay in diagnosing acute coronary syndrome. Dr. Mills is a cardiologist at the University British Heart Foundation Center for Cardiovascular Science at the University of Edinburgh, Scotland. Welcome, Dr. Mills.
Thank you for having me.
Let's see if I can describe this accurately and simply. Maybe I'll oversimplify. Your group examined the implications of a lower diagnostic threshold in 2 6-month phases. In the first phase, you started using a more sensitive troponin assay, but only values above the original diagnostic threshold for ACS, acute coronary syndrome, which was 0.20 nanograms per milliliter, were reported. And in the second phase, you started reporting levels that exceeded 0.05 nanograms as indicating ACS. Is that fair?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. Full points then. But the interesting thing, as I was reading this, is that redefining ACS as occurring at the lower threshold of troponin, the patients in the second phase, where those lower things were reported, had a lower risk of recurrent infarction during 1 year of follow-up than patients with similar but unreported values in the first phase. Are troponin levels so crucial to making this diagnosis?
That is an absolutely key point. Troponin is the cornerstone of diagnosing acute coronary syndrome. Whilst a clinical history and suggestive ECG changes are very important, physicians worldwide rely on biomarkers of myosin necrosis to guide them in their diagnosis. And often a normal troponin is considered very reassuring, and patients are perhaps stratified as lower risk and perhaps treated less intensively.
And I have to say, this is an absolutely brilliant trial design, which I'm sure you already know, but but it's brilliant because it answered several different questions. I mean, the first question was, you know, what is the natural history of those patients with this sort of intermediate zone troponin if you don't do anything? And then what's the natural history of those with this intermediate level troponin if you do something? So if the physician is now persuaded in some ways to do something, so you just define it as abnormal, then they do more. They refer them, they give them antiplatelet agents, and these secondary prevention measures.
That's right.
And then you still had this control group of the low troponin where the management was essentially unchanged, so indicating that the change wasn't just overall improvement in the care of cardiac patients over time. It was real.
That's absolutely right. It's a natural experiment, if you like, to determine whether there is added value in implementing more sensitive assays in order to essentially reclassify patients, some of which will have been diagnosed with unstable angina, and some of them would have been reassured and perhaps told they had non-cardiac chest pain.
Mm-hmm.
But simply by lowering the threshold for troponin and identifying these patients as myocardial infarction has ensured better referral to specialists, better treatment, and ultimately better outcome, with around a 50% reduction mm-hmm. in recurrent admissions with myocardial infarction and death 3 to 12 months.
Now, some hospitals have already implemented these lower thresholds, but for those that haven't, and your paper suggests a significant benefit to doing so.
Indeed.
But what would you say to those that haven't bought into this concept? What would you say to them about the possible unintended consequences of implementing such a lower threshold, if any?
Okay. Well, first of all, I would say that lowering the threshold for troponin and diagnosis of myocardial infarction is a controversial issue for clinicians.
Mm-hmm.
It was an issue that was controversial amongst the acute physicians, cardiologists, and clinical biochemists in our center when the modified or reformulated Abbott Architect assay was made available. And there's no doubt this is a subject that generates controversy and strong views. The concern of lowering the troponin threshold is that we'll see more patients with false positive troponin results in the context of acute illness, mm-hmm. which is not specifically a primary acute coronary syndrome. Of course, that was the concern raised prior to initiating the study. Mm-hmm. What we found was, in fact, only one patient in the over 2,000 patients in this study who was inappropriately diagnosed in acute coronary syndrome, who subsequently came back with a pulmonary embolus 3 months later and received appropriate treatment and did very well. And there is always that concern. But one additional patient in 2000 suspected acute coronary syndrome. It is not a major clinical issue. And the advantages are more accurate diagnosis and therefore better access to treatment, which ultimately translated into significant improvements in outcome in patients with suspected acute coronary syndrome.
Do you have any sense of how ubiquitous this has become already? So how many hospitals around within Scotland or other countries have already implemented these lower thresholds?
It's a great question. Most of the manufacturers of troponin assays have moved towards more sensitive formulations, but how they've been implemented in different centers is very, very variable. We've done, and this is unpublished, but a poll of 40 centres in the UK, and this was done about 6 months prior to the publication of the paper, and asked 20 of the Russell Group universities, the main tertiary hospitals in the UK, and 20 of their affiliated district general hospitals, what assay they were using and what threshold they were reporting to. And less than 50% of them were implementing these sensitive assays to their full effect. There was a reluctance to drop the threshold for the diagnosis of MI. And that, I think, is not something that is exclusive to the UK. And I think throughout Europe and the rest of the world, there are centres where perhaps there's been a reluctance to implement the universal definition of MI in its entirety and drop the threshold to near normal levels.
In that same vein, you alluded to it a little bit, but what reaction, positive or negative, have you received from colleagues about these findings?
Okay. Well, when we first proposed reducing the threshold, there was concern raised by lots of our colleagues about the impact it was going to have on the service, the number of referrals to cardiology, the impact on the coronary catheterization lab, cardiac rehabilitation services, in addition to the impact it's going to have on patients. You know, a diagnosis of myocardial infarction has an impact on psychological well-being, employment, and driving regulations. And all of these issues were thought through very carefully before we initiated this study. But we felt that the potential benefits of improved accuracy in diagnosis and outcomes would outweigh those potential concerns. And yes, we've seen an increase in the number of patients diagnosed with myocardial infarction, approximately 30% increase across the study period. It hasn't been overwhelming for our service, and I certainly would say that none of my colleagues now, and bear in mind we implemented this assay in February 2009, that was the start of the validation period of the study, none of my colleagues have had any real concerns about lowering the threshold, and there was no, you know, overwhelming impact on the service. So I would say to clinicians who are considering dropping the threshold and, you know, really trying to adopt the universal definition where possible within the limitations of their assay, that they shouldn't be overly concerned about that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Mills, the lowering of the threshold means that more people are being treated. However, and that's going to increase costs, and that's something that American physicians are very concerned with. On the other hand, you show that by possibly increasing that cost, or definitely increasing the cost of cardiac care, you're lowering mortality from heart disease.
That's right. You have to be very careful when you try and estimate the impact of this on the health economics of the treatment of patients with acute coronary syndrome, because although the assay itself costs no additional money, and lowering the threshold is a simple clinical decision with no additional cost,
mm-hmm.
there is an increase in the workload of cardiologists and therefore the treatments that they're providing for their patients. And that has to be offset against the benefits of two things. Firstly, reductions in recurrent admissions, which are expensive. Often patients presenting late because they've been inappropriately reassured during their first admission with more significant infarcts. Secondly, there's the cost of unnecessary investigation in patients who present with chest pain where a cardiac diagnosis is not made initially, and they may undergo CT scans and a variety of other tests, endoscopies, that may not be necessary if the appropriate diagnosis was made using a more sensitive assay in the first place. So the health economics is quite complicated and something that I think we need to look into further, and in fact have plans to do in further prospective work. But my feeling is that ultimately this is not going to be a large negative effect on cost. It's quite a difficult concept to get across to the lay public, and I don't think it's critical for the lay public to understand this study. It's important for clinicians to understand it because it's a very simple thing that every department could potentially implement and I think really improve outcomes in their patients. There's going to be limited added value from novel therapies and the treatment of acute coronary disease. We already have very effective treatments, but identifying people who benefit from those treatments is a key goal, and I think that more sensitive assays are going to definitely allow us to do that.
Well, you converted me. We actually are.
You already.
I'm converted. Yes.
You converted.
But there was resistance. I mean, we changed our assay. I think it was about 6 months ago, and there was so much moaning and groaning, and the cardiologists were, oh, are you kidding
me?
We're
going to have, hasn't it? It's blown over. No one notices it.
16,000 consults a day, and it blew over. Yeah.
Well, I tell you, I did three cases in the lab this morning, all of them with troponins of the first guy had some inferior T-wave inversion, lead 3, nothing else. Had a single episode of chest pain. His troponin was 0.08. Took him to the lab, critical dominant right, single stent.
Yeah.
We home now, enjoy the rest of his holidays.
Right.
Second case on the list, troponin of 0.15. Critical in-stent restenosis in a dominant circumflex artery. Normal ECG, atypical sounding pain, but with his raised troponin, they thought, we better get him to cath lab. Absolutely critical restenosis. So two examples, just by chance, in the lab this morning of patients who otherwise my colleagues at the front door of the hospital would probably have reassured and sent home.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it happens all the time. What has astounded me is the emphasis that people put on biomarkers and troponin in their day-to-day management. I like to think that I see the bigger picture and I take my histories and I understand risk better than most doctors. However, you know, a lot of relatively junior staff at the front door in the hospital will put a lot of emphasis, and senior staff, on a troponin. And, you know, it's astounding, really. There was initially some reluctance, and people were still sending people home with small troponin rises going, that's not relevant, you know, just a little,
like, no,
you know.
Really,
you know, you thought, please, come on, that's why we've lowered the troponin threshold.
Right.
And there's loads of scope to increase this, to lower it further, actually. You know, I think we've not bottomed out yet with the next, there'll be next generation assays that will, you know, I hope, and what we'd like to do is study actually using troponin in a more sophisticated way. So instead of saying this is an artificial cut point for MI, say this is what your troponin is and this is what the normal reference range is. You interpret it as you see fit in the context of clinical history.
It's not dichotomous, right? I mean,
no,
it's a spectrum
of these are arbitrary
disease,
thresholds based on assay precision or statisticians.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And what would be much more effective is to say, here's the troponin level. Look at the patient, look at the ECG, take the history, and use that to your best. I mean, I actually think unstable angina will be a diagnosis of the past in the not too distant future.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I don't think there will be patients coming with cardiac chest pain who do not have some evidence of troponin release.
Right.
And I don't think we'll see unstable angina in the future.
We want to thank you for your time with us today.
No problem at all.
Thanks so much.
That's it for Conversation 116. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. For myself and Dr. Danielle Schurer, thank you for listening.